Research into ocean acidification and its impact on animal behaviour is increasingly alarming scientists in the marine biology field. Giulio Rossi is a marine biology PhD student at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide. He has been researching barramundi and the changes they face as climate change takes effect.
The focus of my PhD has been to study the effect of ocean acidification on fish behaviour. And in particular, I looked at how ocean acidification interferes with the ability of baby fish to orient themselves in the ocean and find a place to call home.
The field that you work with is called bioacoustics, is that right?
Yes, it is.
So that's understanding how fish listen to and use those cues underwater?
Exactly, because the sound propagates very well in the water. So it's probably one of the best cues that fish have to orient themselves in the ocean. Because the sound of a reef, which is a really noisy place, can propagate very far, even kilometers offshore. And so when a baby fish, which is like, imagine like less than a centimeter in size, is far in the open waters, it uses the sound as a guide to find the reef where to settle and grow up.
Are fish generally not born at the reef? Are they born in a distance from a reef?
So the way it works is that the adults live typically on the reef. And then they spawn and they release eggs and sperm in the water. And they get fecunded and then they drift with the currents. And then the eggs hatch and the little larva, baby fish, which is in the first day of life, it's just like 3 millimeters. It's really, really tiny. Spends a few weeks in the open waters. And at first, it's weak. Can't really swim when it wants. It goes with the currents. But then when it's about 2 weeks old, it's strong enough that it can actually swim where it wants. So at that point, that's when these cues become important, because the instincts of the fish are saying it's time to move on and leave the water column to go where the place where grown-up fish live, which, depending on the fish we're talking about, could be a reef or could be a mangrove. So in my work, I work with barramundi, which settles in mangroves. So in fact, in my experiments, I use the sound of the mangroves as the cue that this fish needs to find the place where to settle.
I suppose because they're floating on the currents, they could be quite a long way from the mangroves.
Yes, they can be a long way. It's no one really knows exactly how far baby fish can hear this sound. But people think that is at least hundreds of meters, if not kilometers.
They follow this and that's essentially taking them back to where they would then breed and be safe, essentially, as well, isn't it?
Yes, so depending on the fish we're talking about, for example, for barramundi, once it reaches the mangrove, it settles in and it changes lifestyle completely. It becomes an ambush predator. So what then the little barramundi will do is to hide in between the mangrove roots and hunt for prey. And it will stay there for a while until it grows up more, and at that point barramundi moves up to the fresh waters, so it will go up the rivers. It has a really interesting lifestyle because it uses both the ocean and the fresh waters. Wow. As an adult, it lives in the fresh water, but then when the adult want to reproduce, they need to go to the coast because they need to spawn in seawater. And so the larvae then develop in the coastal areas and then settle in the mangroves.
How long does it take for a barramundi in the mangrove region to reach sort of the maturity to the point when they do go up into that fresh water?
I'm not sure, but it's probably a few years.
Okay.
Yeah, these are pretty long-lived animals and they get to really large sizes, as most anglers are well aware. It's a really popular fish for anglers because it's really good fun to catch. It's a fighter. So
they do need to be able to find that security to develop from little babies into mature animals anyway, to then continue that sort of circle of life, I guess.
It's critical because if they don't find the right settlement habitat, the risk then is being exposed to predators, so they will get eaten, or they will not find food, so they will starve, or they will end up in the wrong habitat that just doesn't fit their lifestyle.
Their role as predators in that system, is that an important part of the overall ecosystem for that region, you know, for how the balance of all the other fish and other animals operate?
Definitely. Barramundi are top predators in their environment when they're adults, and they play a really important role because as all top predators, they have a cascading effect on the whole ecosystem. And for example, barramundi will eat a lot of shrimps and other animals that eat detritus, and in that way they indirectly control the amount of detritus that is released by the estuaries. So it's all interconnected in nature. If you take one, like Jenga, take one piece out, the whole thing falls down. So yeah, definitely as a top predator, they have a really important role in the whole ecosystem.
And what you've been finding recent with your research is you've been looking at the impact on ocean acidification on general fish species, but specifically on barramundis. What have you found?
So I will first briefly introduce what ocean acidification is. And basically everyone knows about global warming, which is a consequence of CO2 increasing in the atmosphere and causing greenhouse effect. But there's also a second effect that of CO2 or carbon dioxide, which is making the ocean more acidic. This is called ocean acidification. And at first, scientists thought that it was an issue for all those animals with a calcium carbonate shell. Let's say corals, for example. But recently, we discovered that it actually is a big problem for fish as well, because it changes their behavior. And it basically has a neurological effect. It changes the way a very important neurotransmitter in their brain works. And this results in really radical changes of their behaviors. So in my experiments, what I found is that barramundi raised under current day CO2 concentration would, at settlement stage, be attracted to the sound of the settlement habitat, as you would expect. But then when you raise them under end of century CO2 concentration, according to a business as usual scenario, their behavior is the opposite. So instead of being attracted, they go the other way. So that's you can imagine how detrimental this could be for their survival, because it completely reverses that's a very important instinct for them. It's critical for them to, at the right moment, get in the right place and settle in. If they can't do this anymore, it's quite a big issue at the level of population replenishment and fish stocks and all that.
Yeah, so all of these things that we've talked about with the benefits of barramundi finding that home to develop and grow and then being able to continue that life cycle and spawn again, that just goes out the window. These little tiny animals are just lost at sea, essentially.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much what it seems to be happening.
That's pretty scary.
It is definitely scary. However, I like to think that this is only our worst case scenario. So this is going to happen if we continue on this business as usual path of CO2 emissions. But we have the capabilities today to completely steer away from that scenario and seriously reduce carbon emissions worldwide, so that this type of thing is not going to happen.
So what do we need to do? I mean, that's the big question, isn't it?
My study shows that if we do nothing, we're going to hit a really hard wall. So anything we can do is important, and the more, the better.
What process did you go through in assessing the animals? Did you get out there in the water to assess barramundi, or did you look at them in a lab setting?
When you're working with the fish larvae, it's really hard to be out there, because these animals, we are not really always sure where they are. They're just drifting around, go with currents and so on. So my approach was taking them from a commercial hatchery at their egg stage and they reared them in the lab in two groups. One group was growing under current day CO2 conditions, and the other group was growing under end of century CO2 conditions. And then when they reached a couple weeks of life, so when they were big enough to settle and to be responsive to the acoustic cue of their settlement habitat, I started to test in the lab their acoustic preferences. So what I did is that I made a special chamber with an underwater speaker inside, which was broadcasting the sounds I recorded in the mangroves, which is the place where they want to go. And then I let the fish swim in this chamber, and so they could position themselves in a part of the chamber which had a loud sound level, like you would expect in the habitat, in nature, and the other part of the chamber instead was much quieter. So then I videotaped the movement of the fish from the top, and I analyzed then the movement of the fish with a sophisticated tracking software that gave me numbers about how the fish used its space and where it positioned itself, either closer to the sound or away from the sound. So then by analyzing this type of data, I've been able to see that the control fish, so those that grow under normal CO2 concentration, were indeed attracted to that sound. So they liked it. But those that grew under end of century CO2 conditions were going the other way. So it was a complete reversal of their preference. I'm not the first person finding that ocean acidification can reverse behaviors in fish, which is even more scary because we know that actually this happens also for their preferences towards smells, like odors that they might use. For a really famous example is clownfish, Nemo, has been tested with the smell of its predator. And our colleagues at JCU showed that instead of being scared by the smell of the predator, it will go towards that smell. So that tells a lot of how radical this change in behavior. And at first, to be honest, it was hard to believe to myself because it was too much. I was like, no, this is unbelievable. I'm seeing the wrong thing. And then I had a moment where I realized, okay, this is true. And that was when I went on natural CO2 vents, which are basically natural laboratories for us. It's places around volcanic islands where you have bubbles of pure CO2 seeping through the seafloor and acidifying pockets of water. And you find areas that will resemble an end-of-century scenario. So I went there and I started snorkeling and taking photos of little fish sitting at the bottom of the control site. And it was really hard to take any decent photo because these little fish sitting at the bottom will just dart away as soon as you would approach them for a good photo distance. But then I moved to the area with elevated CO2 concentration, and taking those photos became super easy because the fish were coming closer to me. Instead of darting away, they were coming closer to me and more were coming.
Wow.
And I got an incredible shot really close of this fish that is otherwise pretty much impossible to take. So that was so clear and evident that I was like, okay, wow, this is real. We actually quantified that behavior, but even just as an anecdote was, wow. So ocean acidification does indeed cause massive changes in important behaviors.
You're listening to The Sound of Science, where research comes out of the lab and into your ears, brought to you by the Faculty of Sciences at the University of Adelaide. Hi, I'm Sarah Martin, and this is The Sound of Science, and you're listening to my conversation with Tullio Rossi, marine biology student at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide. I asked him whether his research showed behavioural change in all fish in increased CO2 environments.
We know that it's not just the prey having swimming towards the predator, but it's also the predator becoming a bit stupid. So the final outcome, it's hard to predict, But there's gonna be big changes.
Yeah,
there's gonna be big changes, and we're still a bit far to the complete picture of how the ocean is gonna look like. But we know that when you look at these single elements, or also a couple of species that normally interact in nature, these effects seem to be widespread. And for example, initially I thought was mostly animals that live in a stable environment that are most affected, like coral reef fish. And I thought barramundi, because it has such a flexible physiology and can swap between seawater and freshwater, and lives in estuaries which are naturally really variable in the amount of CO2 that you get in the water, I thought barramundi would be a really tough fish and would not be affected. But instead, to my surprise, it was. And I tested multiple behaviors. And what I found is that, as I earlier said, their preferences towards sounds change, but they also swim slower, which is another thing that's probably not going to help them, because swimming towards their settlement habitat is another important thing to do. And also, I tested them past their settlement stage, so when they live in the mangrove and they're a bit bigger, and this effect of acidification doesn't go away. They're still affected. And what I tested then was their sheltering behavior, which at this stage is very important because they are ambush predators, so they have to hide and wait for the prey and then hunt. And their behavior was completely different. They became a lot shyer. So they spent a lot longer in the shelter than the control fish did, which was pretty surprising. But again, really clear-cut result.
So there's no questioning this result anyway. You're seeing it as a dramatic change in behavior all around in those elements.
In multiple behaviors. And the reason why it's multiple behaviors, that the underlying mechanism is the same. As I said, it's an important neurotransmitter in their brain, which is in our brain too. The GABA neurotransmitter, it's affected when you drink alcohol. It's a very important one, and it regulates pretty much all sorts of behaviors in us as well as it does in fish, and also in invertebrates as well, even in a shrimp. It will be the same kind of neurotransmitter. At the functioning of that neurotransmitter is changed. And so it's not just one behavior that is changing, but it's a whole set of behaviors. So the net effect it becomes really hard to predict, because the whole set of normal behaviors is changed.
So we don't know. Yeah, so there will be nothing, no kind of normal that we can base it on at that point. When these changes have happened, it'll be a whole new normal in pretty much the behavior of all of our ocean animals.
Pretty much. And it will be, the way I imagine this is that some species will be more vulnerable than others. So there will be winners and losers. The ocean will always have fish. The problem is that there will be a less variety, so less diversity. And we will lose probably important species that we like to eat in favor of opportunistic, hardy species that can deal with this changed environment.
And you've created a animation that's won a second place in the Bommy Awards and a third place in the Thinkable Awards.
Yes.
And it's really cute.
I tried to make it.
it tells that story of the barramundi and really breaks down what the difference is that is happening in relation to ocean acidification. What made you decide to venture into this world of creating animations to communicate this issue?
I think that it all started many, many years ago when I was 17 or 18. And I like to play around with Photoshop. And my best friend worked as in the public relation for clubs. And he asked me, you're good with Photoshop. Why don't you try making the flyer for the next party? And so I started one flyers, two flyers, three flyers, and then the thing got started. And actually, I've been doing graphic design for now 10 years, parallel to the uni, and which came handy in many different ways. And now, finally, I see the two things coming together in the form of science communication. Because now all those skills of graphic design are coming really, really handy. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to make such an animation. And so I knew how to do the animation. And then in this last year of university, of PhD, I realized how important is communicating our findings. Because normally what happens with science that we publish in our scientific journals, papers that are full of jargon that no one will even understand if you're outside the field. And that's it, pretty much. It gets picked up by a few scientists, gets cited, but doesn't really reach the masses. However, the whole point of doing this type of research is to see how the ocean is going to look like by the end of the century if we do nothing about our carbon emissions. So I think that getting the word out there, it's all probably even more important than publishing in a scientific journal, because that's the whole point of it, is this, finding out what's going to happen if we do nothing, so that we can decide then to steer away from that direction. So, yeah, I realized that the communication of my findings was very important, and I felt like only half of my job was done if I didn't effectively communicate my results to the public. So it's, it's been also really rewarding, because probably the most rewarding moment was after releasing these videos, having someone I didn't know telling me, thank you for doing this work, this is important. That was it's a little thing, but it meant a lot to me. It was really rewarding.
Well, I imagine when your interests are in the area of ecology and it's such a pressing issue that we start to think about making changes now, that, you know, those kind of knowing that you've reached out to people and maybe compelled them to think about what they do a little different must make a massive difference. It would certainly be the aim, I would expect.
Massive difference. If I just can convince three people out there that we should reduce our carbon emission as fast as we can, it's a win. If I can convince 100, it's a massive win. So,
did you create the animation for a competition, or did you create the animation and then enter it to a competition?
So the competition gave me the good input to say, okay, sit down and do it.
Yeah, everyone needs a deadline.
Yeah, so with the deadline of the competition, I got serious about it and I decided, okay, let's do this. This is the right moment. There's a good chance to get visibility through the competition and even win a prize that actually helped me a lot, because thanks to that cash prize I won in the competition, I've been able to attend a conference in Sydney, the Fish Biology Conference, and that's where I presented my results to the scientific community.
That's great. So they go hand in hand.
Yeah, definitely. They go hand in hand. And I think every scientist should put some effort in that, because it's so important.
One of the things that you were talking about is that difference between breaking down a jargonistic, very much science-speak version of what you've researched, which you need to do to justify being put in a paper and in a journal, but that translation into something that the general public can understand. And for this particular animation, your language is very clear, not dumbed down, but simplified, you know, so that it's very a very understandable message. What process did you go through to have to translate that? Did you find it natural, or did you have to really force yourself to get out of science speak?
It wasn't natural at first. I went to a big international conference in Brazil on climate change, and I realized how bad scientists are at communicating. I was stuck for 5 days in a conference room listening to very dull presentations packed with jargon and irrelevant details. and staying awake was hard. So I thought, maybe it's probably relevant and worthy to invest some time in improving my communication skills. So then I did a couple of things. I read a couple of books about how to effectively communicate science. That's been really, really helpful. And I also started practicing public speaking, which helped me a lot too. Gave me confidence, and as you do it, you learn how to drop the jargon and just explain things in a simple way, using, you know, anecdotes or examples and stuff, things like that.
That's great, because I think the more that people do that, the better that people access science. You know, you're relatively young, so for you, the world of social media is kind of a natural format to be able to put information out and engage the public, I guess, maybe more so than people who have been in a scientific field for a lot longer.
Absolutely.
Do you find that's beneficial for you, that you're sort of almost a digital native on that stuff?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn and ResearchGate and all those. And because I think that people are still not aware about ocean acidification and how big of an issue it is. In the last year, I created a Facebook page called The Ocean Acidification Page, which I invite everyone to like and follow. And I use this page because I thought it was ridiculous that given the gravity of the matter, there was not a single Facebook page talking about this. So I made it. I made it, and every week I post things I find around. I post my content, but also much content that comes from other labs and other people. And it's intended for the general public. You would not find peer-reviewed journals packed with jargon there, but understandable things, which could be an article or a video or a podcast.
That's great. It's good that you break it down and acknowledge that that's the way that maybe we'll get a bit of critical mass on the issue.
Definitely, definitely. And also when I started exposing myself on the social media and on the issue of climate change, I realized how much misinformation is out there. It's unbelievable. And there's lots of people that have completely wrong information and believe in that information blindly. So it's really important to get the right information out there and reach as many people as possible.
Do you find that pseudoscience, or people picking up on the wrong area of science, is a challenge, or gets in the way perhaps of good science communication, because it's people presenting facets of science in their own way?
Definitely. And for example, for climate change, what we're seeing is the people that don't want the world to act on climate change are using the doubt technique, which has been firstly used by the tobacco industry. Tobacco industry for many years convinced people that smoke doesn't really cause cancer. We're not sure about that. So keep smoking. Now the same is happening with climate change. They're saying, oh no, the scientific community is not so sure that it's happening, it's not so sure that it's human-induced, so let's just keep burning coal and fossil fuels like we always did. And that's clearly what's happening. And it caused a massive delay in our action plan. We were aware of global warming 50 years ago. Almost nothing has been done because of this, because of people distributing a message of doubt. Well, in reality, the scientific community has been pretty solid and sure about what's going on for a long time. But they just pick one that says a different thing, and then they say, oh no, but they're not sure. Doesn't matter if 99% of scientists are agreeing that climate change is real and is human-induced.
Giulio Rossi, marine biology PhD student at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide.